Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, here in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana, next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, right next to our Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard. Paint them up, plug them up, fill all those bullet holes in, repaint them, good as new. Get on over here. We're open all summer. Late spring and early fall. So there you go. It is July the 9th. Yeah, July the 9th. Wotan's Day. David Lane's favorite day. Yeah. So let's get to the show. I've dug out from the archive another Sling Blade show. Unfortunately, I don't see a date on it. In fact, I don't see a date on any of these archive tapes. So you're going to have to take what you get, and we'll see how it comes out. So here we go with Sling Blade.
You know, me and technology, we really don't. I mean, I don't hate technology. I'm just not, I don't know. Technology is just all Greek to me. My gift towards the struggle, I truly believe, is my tactical brain. My tactical prowess has been tested many times in the military. I think I told you guys a story at one time when during a training exercise we were supposed to hold a piece of ground, defend a certain hill, and I looked at the terrain on the map and I was just an E4 at the time, which my rank was specialist, but it's the equivalent of a corporal, and I'm trying to tell the E5, the sergeant that was in charge of our reinforced squad, that, you know, he had a setup. He had the machine guns overlooking a big open field. And I'm like, listen, Sergeant, you know, I'm not going to say his name. I don't even know if I remember his name correctly. But I said, you shouldn't have the machine guns covering this big open field. I mean, we're not going to get an infantry assault across this big open field. You need to position the machine guns to cover this wadi. This basically, wadi is like a trench. And it's formed by erosion. And this trench was coming right up this tree line off to our right flank. And I'm like, have the machine guns cover that flank, because that would be the most likely avenue of approach for an infantry assault. It may precede a armored attack that will come across this open field. So have the anti-tank weapons cover the open field, you know, this big open area, and have the machine guns, light squad automatic weapons, cover the trench line. And he wouldn't listen to me. He just put everything across this open field. And sure enough, you know, when a mount attack was happening, I kept my eye on that trench off to our right. And sure enough, we started getting an infantry assault up that way. And I took over the squad, and I'm like, repositioned everybody. We lost some people. Remember, this isn't real combat. We're wearing Miles gear, multiple integrated laser engagement system. You know, when you shoot blanks, it activates this laser on the that's mounted on the barrel of your M16, and it will shoot a laser. And you're wearing a receptacle chest harness, and it'll ring in your ears to let you know that you've been killed. So we wouldn't have lost any guys if the guy would have just listened to me. And then at the after action review, this colonel's asking how. The sergeant, hey, how do you think it went, Sergeant? This and that. You guys survived. You lost a couple guys. Looked like you did pretty good. And I dropped a bomb on this guy. I'm like, no, sir, that's not what happened. This guy's incompetent. I was so pissed off. We shouldn't have lost any guys. But anyways, remember, that was training. It wasn't actual combat. But I just, that's my thing. I have a tactical brain. You know, I'm not real good at technology. Pretty knowledgeable about weapons. You know, Soviet-made weapons, American-made weapons, stuff like that. But you get me on a computer or an iPod, or try to have me punch people's phone numbers into my phone, you know, like, not punch them in, but, you know, like, have them as my contact list, man, I would be lost. Okay, so may this show add to the breaking of chains in your mind. Let me help that along by reading a passage, a little bit of a big passage from Which Way Western Man by William Gailey Simpson. This book has been called the White Man's Survival Guide. It doesn't give anything tactical, it's just, it gives good arguments for our position. Okay. Furthermore, if it is Christianity itself with which we are now concerned primarily, even more than with that residue of Jesus' teaching that furnished the initial impetus out of which Christianity grew, there is yet more Jewishness to be taken into account. Whatever worth there may have been in the religion of Jesus as he himself enunciated it, was, as we have seen, eviscerated and nullified by that of Saul of Tarsus, who has come down to history as the Apostle Paul. Indeed, to my mind, it is a real question whether what became Christianity was it more his religion than that of Jesus. Meaning that the Christianity that we have today, he's making the argument that it could be by the influence more of the Apostle Paul than Jesus Christ himself. A religion about Jesus rather than the religion of Jesus. And of course, no matter what may have been the race of Jesus, Paul was certainly a Jew by blood as well as by religion. He himself boasted that he began as a Pharisee of the Pharisees, meaning he was a very religious guy. And these type of people are all over the Christendom. They have a sense of self-righteousness, but deep down inside, they're just the walking dead. Of course, it will be pointed out rightly enough that all this amalgam of Jesus and Paul in the course of centuries became heavily encrusted and more or less deeply permeated with Arian additions, a theology, a theocracy, an art, and eventually a Nordic feudalism. But at the bottom, in the heart of it all, was the Jew, the instinct and nature and need of a breed of men that the Nordic felt alien to himself and inferior to himself too. And what was all this philosophy and art and social arrangement and organization but the Nordic subconscious acknowledgement of the lack he felt in the Jew's outlook on life and the world, and an effort to round out a view of the universe that would relieve this sense of lack, and in keeping with this, to build a social institution in which he could feel both more at home and more secure? Going on, it says, but the structure as a whole was never fully integrated. As we shall see when I come to my concluding chapter on race, Jew and Gentile, perhaps most of all Jew and Nordic Gentile, belong to two different worlds, and never the twain shall meet. Never shall the two understand each other. Whatever of the Jew, therefore, got into Christianity, whether from Jesus or from Paul, is shot through with the substance and feeling of the religious experience of a race very different from the race that has chiefly made European civilization. These last, whether they came from ancient India, Persia, Greece, and Rome, or from the northern Italy, Spain, Germany, France, and Britain or Scandinavia, have been predominantly Teutonic, Indo-European, or in any case, Gentile. Christianity, therefore, and inevitably, has been a contradiction among us. This alone is enough to account for the fact that it has been a religion that we have professed but rarely practiced. Or even worse, when we have practiced it, it has often been to our hurt, for it does not fit us. Think about that. Nietzsche said the time of European history, right after the fall of Rome, was really the Jewification of the West. 15 centuries, a little over 15 centuries, we've dealt with Christianity. Think of all the women that were executed in Europe, burned at the stake, mainly because they were assertive women, or they used home remedies to cure things. I've heard it said before that the gods of the old religions are the devils of the new religion. Lucifer was a Roman god of enlightenment, yet Lucifer is the devil in the Christian Bible. So, Christianity has successfully cut off the balls of European man. And the people and the white people who rail against us, who assault us in the ARA and other places, the white people who counter-demonstrate against us, are there for maybe two reasons, I think. One, because of racial guilt. And two, because of an inferiority complex. Maybe a certain one of these skinhead punk rock girls, not skinhead, but punk rock girls, hated the pretty girls in high school because she wasn't one of them. So she has an axe to grind. There's too many people in our race who have an axe to grind against the best of our race. I myself do not feel inferior at all when I'm around a superior white man. Absolutely not. I feel encouraged. So much so that I say, I hope his seed goes on. I hope he has a lot of kids. Too many white men in our race have a chip on their shoulder. You know, and I've fallen prey to this myself. You know, I am by no means considered a good-looking guy. I don't have an athletic physique. So, and there have been times in my life where I hated the beautiful people. Looking back on that now, I guess that I only want the beautiful people to not be so haughty and not look down their nose. But I've changed in the fact that I don't want nothing negative to befall them. It's better for our race if their seed multiplies on this planet. Even if mine doesn't. And I hope a lot of you agree with me out there. If there's a racialist out there, let's say she's a female listening to this show. Let's say she's got brown hair. She's got brown eyes. She may not be considered very pretty. You know, maybe, and only she can make that determination because of how she grew up. Don't hold it against those of our race that are beautiful. What I hate are very beautiful white women who are nothing but bimbos on the arm of Hugh Hefner, who I hope dies very soon. Hugh Hefner is not good for our race. In fact, I'm suspicious of the guy being a Jew. He probably is. I hate the guy who produced the Girls Gone Wild videos. I think his last name is Francis, but he looks kind of Jewish to me. I hate white women who act like whores, who strip on dance poles. Now, don't forget, a beautiful white woman doing some exotic dancing before a crowd of white men, that's fine. I would like her to know some things, though. I would like her to know some things about her race and stuff like that. But for all of us, all the white men in that club, let's say it would have to be an exclusively white club, can revel in the beauty of a white woman. I think that's great. As long as it doesn't get raunchy. I don't want it to get raunchy. I don't want her to be inserting things into her body. Absolutely not. That shit, that's the kind of stuff that was all over the place in Germany during the Weimar Republic. That cabaret stuff. So, we need not be jealous of those who were born of a better stock than us. We need to feel confident. We need to feel glad. All right. Okay, I'm going to be reading from the Paranoid Newsletter here. And this will be the fifth edition of the Paranoid Newsletter. This newsletter is for the person who takes their privacy very seriously. Let's face it, America is a police state. Anything the government doesn't like is now considered terrorism. I've read that intro on a couple of the tapes before, and I'll save the time now. Handling the everyday risk of leading a double life. The heroes and heroines of the American Revolution held a deep conviction that everybody and everyone everywhere has the right to revolt against tyranny and oppression. Many Americans today are wondering if they should become active in resisting government tyranny. Some are asking themselves, do I love my country but fear my government? Answer one question and you've answered both. The element of risk. Is there risk involved? Yes. Anyone who questions or challenges the status quo is a target for surveillance and repression by the authorities. Anyone who undertakes covert actions must accept an even greater risk. Their primary duty as an underground activist is security. You must remain unknown to the adversary's forces and to the public at large. Simply stated, exposure is the greatest threat you face as an underground activist or as an urban guerrilla. This risk falls into three categories. You know what? I have a number of paranoid newsletters, and I hope I didn't read this one. If I did, well, maybe some things need repeating. I'm not really sure. I've done a lot of shows in the last couple of weeks, so I hope this will be all right. Sources of risk, commonplace. Everyday situations are the main source of risk. People are surprised to learn this. Three main causes of exposure are, first, being in the wrong place at the wrong time when the police are looking for someone else. Second, being noticed by a security service while they're watching someone else. And third, being reported to the authorities by a busybody or a nosy neighbor. Reduce or eliminate these three situations and you've removed 98% of the danger in leading a double life. This article teaches you how to minimize the risk of a double life you may lead. The article contains enough background information to keep you out of the internment camps. Combined with it, the other articles in the Paranoid Newsletter, you'll know enough to begin planning and carrying out your covert activities. Threat number one, the wrong place at the wrong time. Threat involves being inadvertently and innocently swept up in an investigation. You're simply in the wrong place at the wrong time when the police are looking for someone else. When you're this close to them, arouse their interest and you're finished. Situation can develop around you unexpectedly. They can get out of control even quicker. They include mundane events like random vehicle stops by police. More serious situations include muggings, holdups, shoplifting, drunk driver, road checks, prowlers, burglaries, retail video cameras, and others. All these situations will bring the police close by. Case study number one, October 1998. I was scheduled to meet a clandestine contact. The location was the entrance to a city park just after dark. I arrived 10 minutes early in order to give myself time to check for surveillance. The park is laid out as a linear trail. It meanders through various neighborhoods in the city. Unbeknownst to me, just moments earlier, a punk had held up a nearby convenience store. He used the trail for his getaway. I parked my car and walked to the meeting location and checked for surveillance. Satisfied that the area was clean, I was walking back to my car. Suddenly, out of nowhere, a large dark sedan pulled out of the shadows. A male got out of the car and crept along the dark side of a building adjacent to the park. He hadn't seen me, but I was thinking perhaps it was a prowler, a burglar, or a drug-related situation. A challenge in the dark. As I approached my car, the suspicious male shone a flashlight on me. He was about 25 yards away, using a firm voice. I challenged him, "Can I help you with something?" "It's the police." "Oh, sorry," I called back. "I didn't recognize you." I started walking towards him in a non-threatening way as if I had nothing to hide. Sit rep. I had a number of things going for me. I was well-dressed. I was wearing a sports coat and tie. So somewhat overdressed for the part, and I had just reacted in a manner that suggested I was not going to accept being challenged by a stranger in the dark. All these factors may have reduced the cop's suspicion a bit. As he and I approached each other in the dark, he came right out and told me that he was checking the park as a possible getaway route for a robbery suspect. I played my cover and began acting worried. Gee, thanks for the warning. I was just in there. Summary. Picture it in your mind. It's just him and me on a deserted street in an industrial area after dark. He's all pumped up looking for an armed robbery suspect. It wouldn't have taken much for things to get out of hand. His next move. Following standard police procedure, he now needed to rule me out as a suspect and find out what I was doing. After all, here I am hanging around a park after dark. He asked me for identification. I showed him my driver's license. Then he asked me what I was doing. I'm going down to, says name of bar here, let's say for example, O'Reilly's. I'm going down to O'Reilly's to sing some karaoke, I replied. Looking at my watch, it was 20 to 9. It doesn't start till 9, I continued. So I'm just killing time a little bit. He smiled and handed me back my ID card and said, well, you're not 24. Have a good night. Home free. I can safely assume that the robbery suspect was described by the convenience store clerk as a 24-year-old male. I'm 40-ish. The lesson? You simply never know when circumstances are going to overtake you. You cannot predict when you're going to be challenged by the authorities. Plausible deniability is the best way. Now, this Fahrenheit newsletter came to me, but I think the pages were out of order, so hope that's okay.
What was that final word there?
Is the best way to ensure that a routine challenge doesn't escalate into a major confrontation. As an underground activist, you must have an innocent explanation for everything you do. That's right. Have a cover story for everything. That's not over-analysis. That's just a good way of doing things. In my case, I also had a backup. Or no. In my case, I also had a backstop, which is spy talk for an actual event that backs up my cover story. Meaning, there was karaoke at that bar that he was going to. I mean, if the cop wanted to check out the bar, there was definitely karaoke that was going to start at 9 o'clock. So it's good to know what's going on in a general area so you can use that as a cover story. Tell the cops what they want to hear. Help simplify their job for them. Play your cover for all it's worth. Be a stereotype. Make it easy for them to label you, to pigeonhole you, to typecast you, and they'll rule you out as a suspect. Pigeonhole you means, you know, help that cop build in his mind that he's just a businessman who's going to a karaoke bar, sing some karaoke, maybe hook up with a female. Who knows? Play that cover to the hilt, you know? I was just some naive dandy on his way downtown to sing karaoke on a Saturday night. Yeah, right. Give them what they want. An important component in your plausible deniability and your cover is to give the authorities something to find. Let them discover a personal character weakness or a minor transgression. They seldom look further. Intelligence agencies like Britain's MI6, Germany's BND, and France's DGSE, and Russia's KGB, now the SVR, have been doing this for decades. It's called layered security. The damage? None. I simply reschedule my rendezvous with my contact, a whistleblower, and an alphabet agency. Now, this is what I don't understand. Maybe you guys can. He says an important component in your plausible deniability in your cover story is to give the authorities something to find. Let them discover a personal character weakness or a minor transgression. I wish you would elaborate on that. What the fuck does he mean by that? What, being in a park after dark, is that a character weakness? Is a character weakness acting scared that somebody's shining a flashlight in his face? I don't know what he meant by that. If any of you do, maybe you've had a background doing this kind of thing, explain it. Okay, summary, threat, unexpected police challenge, defense, plausible deniability, good covered, layered security, and a backstop. Implement. I guess the backstop is that bar that's having karaoke at 9 o'clock. That was really happening. You know, that's your backstop. Implementation. I believe that's correct. I could be wrong. Implementation. Dress well. Be clean and neat. Be polite. Play out your cover. Be a stereotype. Act non-threatening. Threat number two. Being noticed by the security service. The threat involves being noticed by the security service when they're actually watching someone else. In other words, you inadvertently walk through a surveillance operation. During your meetings with various contacts, eventually you find yourself talking to someone who is under surveillance. The surveillance team will want to know more about you. The mere fact that you've contacted their target is enough reason for them to place you under surveillance. They don't have anything on you yet, but the situation is extremely dangerous for you. A common trap. A situation like this can easily develop as a result of your routine interaction with other activists, urban guerrillas, cells, networks, couriers, go-betweens, suppliers, informants, whistleblowers, agent handlers, and so on. Any one of these contacts might be under surveillance, vehicle surveillance, foot surveillance, or technical surveillance. The defense against this threat is to use good tradecraft. Use the blunt modine, B-L-U-N-T, first word, second word, M-O-D-I-N. Use the blunt modine method of arranging secret meetings. Use dead drops. Use anonymous email accounts. Use one-time pads, whatever that is. Learn to recognize the warning signs of surveillance. Use elliptical conversations, that's coded language. Use diversions and decoys. Use misinformation. Use code words. For example, I heard of a guy who was going on a crime spree, but before he went on a crime spree, he told everyone he knew that he was relocating to another state for a job opportunity. He said goodbye to everybody through phone calls and emails and letters. And then a week later, went to a different location and just raised holy hell. That's a good way to use misinformation. Use code words. Use these skills. Make it possible. All these skills make it possible for you to continue your underground work while under surveillance. Most important, however, is your cover. You want to appear as one of the non-thinking sheep. Make yourself uninteresting to the surveillance team. You know, I like what he said here. All these skills make it possible for you to continue your underground work while under surveillance. Too many of our people get paranoid. You know, they get questioned by the FBI one time, and they just freak out. That needs to stop. Or we need to somehow get a bunch of hardcore type of people in our struggle. All right. Fail safe. Even if you don't detect the presence of the surveillance team, good tradecraft and a good cover will keep you free. The goons will watch you long enough to satisfy themselves that you're not a suspect. And then they'll move on. The cardinal rule is don't break cover, ever. Let them hear what they want to hear. A sheep. Okay. A sheep bleating. Bleating, you know, bah. Let them see what they want to see, a sheep grazing. Help them rule you out as a suspect. Case study number two, August 1998. One of my regular contacts was under intermittent police surveillance. That's because she had occasional contact with nasty underworld types. She and I discussed nothing by telephone. Wow, that's very smart. We only use random parks, noisy bars for our conversations. Sometimes we use cutouts or go-between to pass messages to each other or set up meetings. I think cutouts, I think that's that dark space between buildings, right? I think I'm right. I'm not sure. My cover was that of a naive dandy who was hopelessly infatuated with a bad girl. Layered security. As in the previous risk analysis, it's important to realize that an essential element in your plausible deniability and your cover is to give the authorities something to find. What does he mean by that? Let them discover a personal character weakness or a minor transgression. They'll seldom look further. Intelligence agencies have been doing this for decades because it works. You know, if someone out there knows exactly what that means, email blackhoodedsaxon@gmail.com and give me a very good example of it. All right, threat. Notice by security service, defense, good tradecraft, a credible cover, and layered security. Threat number three, being reported to the authorities. The threat involves being reported to the authorities. Do you want your tape I have left? All right, we're going good. All right, threat involves being reported to the authorities by a busybody or a nosy neighbor. These so-called anonymous tips happen a lot more often than people realize. The threat is from the passerby, the bystander, the witness, the jilted lover, the jealous coworker. This is one of the most dangerous threats to your double life, but it is also one of the easiest threats to neutralize. The answer? Good cover and plausible deniability. This means looking like you belong and having an innocent explanation for whatever it is you're doing. Well, you know, that goes with having a good cover story for everything you're involved with. Says here, this is one of the most dangerous threats to your double life, but it's a lot easier. Oh, jilted lover and a jealous coworker. You gotta watch out how you're. See, this is why it is time for racially aware white men to go underground with their thoughts and their feelings. Because if you piss someone off, and they know you're this hardcore racist, and they know that you've had run-ins with the FBI. They'll call the FBI and fabricate shit about you. And let's say that the timing is just right. They happen to give the FBI a tip and fabricate something false about you just at the same time that you're starting to get active with something. Then all of a sudden you're under surveillance. So, if you keep your racial view secret, and by the way, if you do keep your racial view secret, you have to be a ghost wolf, man. Okay? If some of you out there totally insist on being above ground, then you have to keep talking about race and demonstrating and doing whatever. But I hope there's some of you out there that are true ghost wolves. And you got to stop talking about race, stop getting pissed off in front of people about a certain news event. Start learning to control yourself. And when people ask, wow, you seem different. You don't seem like this badass racist no more. I say, yeah, I've been doing a lot of thinking. You know, I mean, do whatever, as long as you are active in the most influential way. Okay? So don't let anyone screw you up. You can't help it if the passerby or a stranger or bystander watches something. But you can't control the jilted lover and the jealous coworker. Watch out your human relations, your relationships. Be careful. Don't trust nobody with anything. All right. Your public persona must provide adequate cover for your activities of your underground persona. Of course, this only works if you keep your mouth shut. Don't brag about your activities to friends or lovers. Don't engage in pub talk unless you're among cell members. Keep your political opinions to yourself. Wow, that is right on. Case study number three. The research that I undertake during my investigative reporting for the spy counter spy website provides good cover for the serious contacts I need to make. My research activities provide plausible deniability while I meet or communicate with informants for alphabet agencies, whistleblowers from government departments, activists in underground organizations, confidential sources in law enforcement and the media, tipsters, ex-military types, ex-spooks, and so on. What we really talk about is between me and my contacts, of course. With a little thought, you can exploit or create activities in your lifestyle that provide good cover for the things you'd rather be doing. Yep, we definitely need to start putting our minds to stuff like that. you know, getting involved in a certain organization, hopefully being able to use an alias to get close to someone who's an enemy of the race. Definitely. Summary. Report it to the authorities. Defense. Good cover. Be part of the community. Fit in. Be friendly. Be a stereotype. If possible, have a solid backstop. Meaning, I guess he means cover story by that. All right. Now we're moving into something else here. You know what? We're not. We're not going to move into that. We'll talk about, what is this? Anonymously and instantly move money via reloadable debit cards. All right, I'll read this, but I think maybe Lone Wolf DC needs to be the one who expounds on this. But because I got so many tapes, I'll save this for a show by itself. But some of the things that this guy talked about leaving a double life, he was definitely right on. I'm going to finish the rest of this show talking about somebody who seems to be a very interesting character. He was the leader of the Cypriot cell that fought against the British occupation in Greece while on Cyprus, General Grivas. Although Grivas is the archetype of the conservative military, man, a jingo and a fascist in the eyes of the Greek communist, his philosophy of terrorism approaches that of anarchist. The state exercises authority by the use of threat of force, argued the anarchist. The policeman on the corner is an agent as well as the symbol of it, and the revolver at his side is there to intimidate or in the extremity to kill those who resist him. If then his authority is illicit, being exercised without the just consent of the governed, is it not right and natural to oppose force with force, to kill the policeman as one would kill bandits, and to combat usurpers as one would combat an invasion? Yeah, that makes more sense. And that's something you ask yourself. Is it not right and natural to oppose force with force, to kill the policeman as one who would kill bandits, and to combat usurpers as one would combat an invasion? You know, the system will send you to war to fight and kill Arabs, but it only serves their purpose. Here we are, we're losing our country, but nobody wants to fight a bloody war. Save our race. I wonder if these jet streams I see in the sky, I wonder if they're secretly pacifying white people. I wouldn't be surprised. In his memoirs, he writes that it was with deep regret, but with a high sense of duty, that he took up arms in 1955 against an old friend and ally, Britain. He blames not the British people, but a band of politicians who denied even a hope of freedom to Cyprus. And he adds, it is on their heads, and the guilt rests with the death of so many men, women, and children in the tragic years that followed. The beginning of the Cypriot struggle for independence was announced March 31, 1955, by a series of explosions across the island. Saboteurs raiding the government radio station in Nicosia set off bombs and wrecked government radio station. Okay. I'm going to move on ahead here because I think I've read this stuff on another show. So I'm going to jump ahead here. The wave of bombing attacks was coupled with more general political action. Young students and school children were rapidly recruited into the independent movement. Well, definitely, we're not in no way to be doing any recruiting now. I would just love for this first stage, we already got first stage taken care of. We've been putting out flyers for decades now. Okay? If those of you are out there, if that's all you can do, then I have respect for that. If that's all you can do because of your health, because of your age, because you're a young guy, but you got you know, you have a bright and promising future as an engineer or something like that, then that's fine. But I'm hoping there's some people that are like in my shoes. I'm hoping that there's Radio Club listeners who are middle-aged, disaffected, marginalized, unemployed. You know, I'll never forget that speech Tom Metzger gave at a National Alliance meeting. I wasn't there, but I had it. I bought it on video. I think 2002 I bought it. And he basically gave a speech saying that people that are going to get this thing started, meaning, you know, racial revolution, are the throwaway kids. I'm sure hoping there's some throwaway kids listening to these shows. Not that I see you as cannon fodder, absolutely not. But you may be the ones that have the balls to get this started. Now, activists in Russia? I haven't seen it, but I heard that there's a video on the internet about a group of Russian skinheads cutting off the head of an Arab or a Muslim. Russian beheading on Google or whatever. I haven't seen it, but I heard it's pretty gruesome. Who knows? It probably was taken off the air or something that bad. But the Russians are doing some things, and I we don't hear about it too much over here. But they got some problems over there. One in five Russians is a Muslim. 43% of the Russian military is Muslim. The Jews worked overtime to destroy Russia. Maybe because of what Kipling said. Maybe that what Kipling said scared them. All right. I intended to turn the youth of Cyprus into the seabed of the EOKA, writes Grivas, in a series of successful demonstrations was organized, significantly violent to drive police from the streets and to require the use of soldiers to restore order. Children as young as 10 years old were used to distribute flyers and to act as couriers. Teachers who interfered and disregarded the organization's warning were punished severely. A phrase that, as Grivas employed it, usually meant shooting by the EOKA execution squads. Pressure was put on Cypriot newspapers that were slow to take the right tone with regard to the campaign. For example, newspapers that failed to denounce the passage of repressive laws. Those of weak spirit soon felt the weight of the EOKA boycott. Sounds to me like they knew how to handle things over there. We have absolutely no fear and no respect from anyone in the United States. Nobody respects us, and they sure don't fear us. I truly believe it's time for that to change. The wave of terrorism that had been initiated by an extremely small group of men, not more than 80, according to Grivas, organized into sabotage squads of 5 or 6 in all of the principal cities and towns of the island. We can do that with just one guy each. Just one ghost wolf. Choose an area to operate in and doing it. And that'll be great. There were as yet no guerrilla units, although Grivas has personally reconnoitered the island, making notes of favorable places for ambushes, terrain suitable to provide base for guerrilla action, and so on. The excellent network of roads across the island militated against an extensive guerrilla campaign. And most of those who were to fight as guerrillas were not sent into the countryside until they had outlived their usefulness in the towns by becoming too well known to risk being seen in the streets. The mountains of the Kyrenia Range and the heavily wooded Trudeau's Range in the southwest were, however, subsequently used as bases of guerrilla operations and for training of sabotage teams. After the first outbreak of bombings, there was a lull in the terror campaign, broken for some weeks only by isolated attacks against what Grivas calls targets of opportunity. One of these, according to the memoirs, was Sir Robert Armitage, the British governor of Cyprus. Want to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs. Comically, the British did not take this piece of information seriously. Something up there about some propaganda, whatever. Too much reading, though, so cut to the chase here. Take this piece of information seriously, recalls Grivas. The idea that an elderly retired officer as the leader of the EOKA was too strange for them to accept. Digenis, D-I-G-H-E-N-I-S. Digenis continued to move about freely in a thin disguise of dark glasses and a clipped mustache. For a time, he established a headquarters in the mountains, but later, he relates, he hid in a house in Limassol for 2 years without ever being discovered or betrayed. Interesting. The EOKA's second wave of attacks came in June. The first victim of the campaign was a policeman killed when a bomb blew a hole in the wall of Divisional Police Headquarters in Nicosia. 16 men were wounded. A sergeant was killed when he was when an assault group attacked the Amandios police station, and several other stations were attacked. Grivas had personally selected a target. The Commander-in-Chief of British Land Forces in the Middle East, General Knightley, who was accustomed to drive daily into the capital from his home on the Kyrenia coast. I found a good place for an ambush on the pass over the Kyrenia Mountains, writes Grivas. But Archbishop Makarios, Archbishop Makarios vetoed the plan, and the idea was abandoned. The memoirs reveal that Makarios vetoed a good many plans proposed by the leader and often dragged his feet when Grivas would have forged boldly ahead. The Archbishop held the purse strings. Without funds, Grivas was unable to proceed and was forced to reconsider some of his more drastic schemes, as for example, when he wished to send execution squads to London to assassinate known Cypriot informers living in Britain on the rewards of their betrayal. Wow, this guy balls. And who's the guy who castrated a lot of their activities? An archbishop, a Christian. How many times are we going to hear this and allow it to happen to us? Christian church is the enemy, comrades. They are the enemy. It is an enemy institution, and it needs to be dealt with such. Oh, I don't want to do that, but God may punish me. Well, if you have that view, even if that's a closet view of yours, you might want to go on to something else and not be part of the struggle. Because you will always be paralyzed by that. In general, however, the campaign proceeded as Grivas wished it to, with the leader maintaining a rigid discipline over his scattered troops of terrorists and saboteurs. I cannot stress saboteurs enough. Saboteurs would be very effective in America. Only for Chinese occupation, though. Right. I issued frequent warnings that I alone would give orders. Disobedience would be punished by death. Although Grivas says that at the onset he would have been able, given 500 armed men to drive the British into the sea, the remark is not to be taken seriously. From the start, he saw very clearly that his victory would be a political rather than a military one. This was made clear in a general plan which he drew up in Athens 2 years before the first bomb exploded in Nicosia. I think I'll stop right there. We're getting close to the end anyway. But I definitely want to use interesting points of interest in the war to flee. And flee for us means forward-looking, enterprising Aryans. Forward-looking. We've already squandered too much time and too many resources. We've got politicians and talk show people like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity Glenn Beck, telling America, and then we have politicians who talk to these guys on the air, and they keep saying, oh, Americans are so angry, Americans are so angry. I think that is a calculated thing for them to keep saying that so that we won't do anything revolutionary. Because I think deep down inside, Americans feel some kind of justification hearing their politicians say, well, Americans are so angry right now. I'm telling you, I think there's some I truly believe there's some psychological intentions going on with that. And don't forget that there are people in high places in this country who know the mind, who know how to manipulate the mind very well. There are billion-dollar think tanks in the Western world that specialize in coming up ways to separate you from your money. They know how to package everything from the color to the look to the theme to the smell, everything. They know how to market that stuff to everybody and different strokes for different folks. If I go to Lane Bryant, I'm not going to see anything in there. But if I go to Dick's Sporting Goods store and I have $500 in my pocket, I'm telling you, I could spend that whole $500 on stuff I like in Dick's Sporting Goods stores. Shotguns, camouflage stuff. You can buy a ghillie suit at Dick's Sporting Goods stores. It's like it's made of nylon. You just put it over your hunting clothes. It may be a good idea to buy one of them because they're made of nylon and the air just goes right through it, so you're not going to sweat to death. You put it right over your hunting clothes. It's like a nylon mesh, and it's raggedy looking, so it breaks up your outline. And it's very sturdy, too. It can run through the woods, and it's not going to snag on trees. Or if it snags, it's not going to rip. So we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children, and that can only be done by racial holy war. Starve the sheep inside you and feed the wolf. Carpe noctem, seize the night. 14.
Well, there he goes. Mr. Slingblade. Yeah, I'm not sure the date on that show. In fact, I've got a whole bunch of them here in the archive box that I'm not sure the date on, but that's all right. It's got a lot of good stuff on there. And that's about it for today. Wotan's Day, July the 9th. That's right. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Thor's Day. That's right. I'll be with you. And in the meantime, get ready to, yea, though I walk through the valley of the Weimar Republic, I shall fear no evil, for my rod and my staff and my machine gun are with me, and my IEDs are in the trailer. Oh, I'm just kidding, ATF. Don't come running out here and wasting the money. Later, 14-5.